When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. For new episodes delivered to you every Thursday, make sure to subscribe, and if you'd like to, you can also leave us a rating and a review. This week we're marking the start of the English Heritage jousting season, with everything you wanted to know about knights, armour and chivalry. Armed with the answers to your questions from social media, our curator of collections and interiors for the East Region, Dickon Whitewood.
Hello.
And jouster, author and independent scholar of arms and armour, Tobias Capwell.
Hi everybody.
Well, let's set the scene, gents, first of all. So, who were knights and what period in English history are we talking about here? Who wants to start us off?
I'm happy to. So knight, obviously that's a huge question. Who were knights? I mean, but in terms of the period of history we're talking about, we're talking from the 11th century all the way through until the early 1600s. So it's a span of almost 500 years. And as you'd imagine, things change massively over that time. But in simple terms, I suppose the knights were the warrior elite of the medieval period. They were often mounted, highly trained, would have worn armour, and certainly in the beginning of this time period, they fought in return for their lord or their king, in return for status and land, and that in and of itself brought wealth through which they could propagate and perpetuate their knightly warrior status.
Were they a little bit like police as well, would you say, Tobias? And we'll call you Toby as well, won't we, on this podcast?
I wouldn't say they're like police. I mean, they have a role to enforce the will of their lord or king, but police forces are really an alien concept in the Middle Ages. As Dickon said, first and foremost, this is the elite aristocratic warrior class, and they're defined by the fact that they have the best equipment, the best training. They have no other job but to fight. So when they're not actually fighting, they're training to fight. They're training their horses, practicing with their weapons. And ultimately, it is about horsemanship. Chivalry, chivalry, just means horsemanship. The knight is differentiated from any other type of warrior in another culture. The difference between a warrior and a knight is that a knight fights from the back of his horse, and he uses very specific tactics, heavy cavalry tactics with the lance, designed to break enemy formations with heavy cavalry charges. And it's the very specific modes of combat that really define the knight and what his status requires.
Before we get on to some questions from our listeners, there's another sort of intro question we should cover, and that's what knights' lives were like.
Well, chivalry is developing rapidly over the course of the High Middle Ages, and when you ask what is a knight, you sort of have to be specific about what period you're talking about, because they kind of evolve as a culture. And the jousts that people will see this summer at English Heritage sites are jousts of the 15th century in the late Middle Ages, and by which time the knight was no longer just a mounted warrior. He was also someone who had tremendous cultural status, political responsibility, and a kind of literary status as well. You know, part of the trouble of having a large number of heavily armed and very well-trained warriors is the question of how to control them and how to limit, you know, their violent capability. And one of the main features of the sort of evolution of chivalry in the High Middle Ages is the connecting of the knight and his, you know, his violent aspect with a literary culture, a culture which prized education and poetry and a kind of a mythic sense of the whole culture. And also the church, you know, the knights were the defenders of Christendom. And the church was very keen to have some say in what they did and how they behaved, and trying to institute a whole a system of behavior and laws and modes of conduct, trying to, again, to mitigate and limit, you know, that aggressive capability. So the knight is, he has a religious or spiritual aspect as a warrior of God. He also has this romantic literary status as a hero of poetry and song and the ideals of chivalry, defending women and orphans and all that. And then there is the military side as well. So they're kind of quite complex creatures. And knights, they're a very diverse group of people. Their financial means can vary a lot, and their attitude to the different aspects of knighthood and the way they as individuals emphasize one or the other. Some are hardcore crusaders, and that's all they want to know about. And others love fighting in tournaments and writing poetry and singing songs. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can interpret knighthood.
That's really interesting. Even though they are sort of almost these quasi-mythical characters, but they did exist in reality, let's talk about what they ate, because I think that's an important part of living as a knight, isn't it? You've got to be well-fed. I think it's Rimar.man or Rimar.man from Instagram wants to know about diet. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's a nice question, because it is, as you say, it's very important to remember that knights are real human beings. You know, they're surrounded by a lot of mythology, but they are real human beings, even though their own culture kind of wants you to be confused about the difference between a kind of mythical superhero and an actual human being. But asking yourself, you know, a basic question like, what did these people eat, is a good one. I'm not a culinary expert, but I suspect they needed to have quite a high protein diet. They probably ate quite a lot of fish, bread, meat. There's, interestingly, in the statutes of the Order of the Band, the 13th century Iberian Order of the Band, one of the first earliest knightly orders of chivalry, one of the regulations said that knights should not eat vegetables. It's not quite clear what they had against vegetables, but the high protein Atkins end of the diet is probably what knights tended to emphasize.
We have a whole load of household accounts from the medieval period, which give the expenses, daily expenses, weekly expenses, monthly expenses of medieval households. And I mean, certainly there were, you know, huge expenses on fish and meat, and then sort of rich spices and honeys and what have you in order to flavor them. So we have these type of documentary evidence to supply us so that some of that information. But we also have, as well, scientific analysis. I mean, I'm sure everybody who's listening knows that in the last decade or so, Richard III was found under a car park. And, you know, that was a time where actually, because his remains were then scientifically analysed, they could then test to see what he'd been eating. And it showed that a huge amount of his diet was from meat, which would have been rich meats, beef and pork and what have you. And then there was a whole load of seafood as well. And interestingly, it showed that in the last 2 years of his life, when Richard obviously was king, his diet got even richer, as you'd expect, because he was feasting and what have you. And as we know, Richard was a knight, you know, famously led a charge at the Battle of Bosworth and died. But in other respects, his life was typical of a knight. And certainly his diet, although perhaps when he was a king, it was even richer before that, I suspect that it was quite typical of what a wealthy nobleman who were also knights would have been eating.
Well, let's move on to some detailed questions now about jousting, which is part of knight life. First of all, what's the difference between tournaments and jousting? Toby, you're the expert on this one. You've ridden horseback.
Yes, I mean, I started my work on this as a five-year-old boy who wanted to be a knight. And I sort of wanted to do things. I wanted to learn to ride horses and fight and wear armor and all of that a long time before, you know, I developed an academic specialism in this area and started working in museums and so forth. So I've always been a practitioner of these things at the same time as I'm trying to be a scholar of them. But, you know, tournaments, jousts, all of this, it really grows out of a basic problem, the problem of training. How do you train your warriors so that they are accustomed to the environment of battle, the combat environment? How do you train them so they'll be comfortable and be able to cope and be able to thrive and succeed in warfare? It's a really a tricky question, because you need training. You need it to be safe so you don't kill all your people in training. But it can't be too safe, because if they know it's not dangerous, then it won't really prepare them mentally or physically. So good military training has to sort of be as close to the real thing as you can possibly get without getting everyone killed. And that's really where tournaments come from. People had been fighting from horses for a long time. That was nothing new. But introducing heavy cavalry tactics, where a group of knights is working very closely together at high speed, working in formation to break an enemy line and fighting with the heavy cavalry spear, wearing, you know, as much armor as is available at the time, all of that requires very specialized training and continual practice. We're talking about martial arts skills here that are in many ways analogous to playing a musical instrument, in that if you want to be really good at it, you have to start when you're a child and you have to practice all of the time. And tournaments and jousts, first and foremost, grow out of the need to practice. And they are, in a sense, you know, war training for warfare, using the same weapons and armor used on the battlefield. And we're talking really about the earliest jousts and tournaments in the 12th century. The basic tournament is really just this kind of formalized battle-like exercise. It's fought in teams, mostly on horseback, but it could degenerate into foot combat as well. Early tournaments involved infantry as well as cavalry, and it's fought over wide areas of open countryside. As a phenomenon, tournaments first appear in northeast France, which is incidentally the same part of the world where you first see heraldry appearing. And it's likely that the development of heraldry and tournaments sort of go together, because you need to be able to tell who's on what team in such a setting. And then, of course, audiences start to appear and people want to watch this. So you can see how a kind of formalized situation develops, where it starts as training, but then becomes a kind of social phenomenon.
So it's almost like, you know, a major sports team has got a logo, and that's their heraldry, isn't it? And then they've got their colours, and then they sort of have their team.
Right. We have to remember that, you know, the past is populated by human beings just like us, and we follow in our behaviours some very ancient patterns. You know, once you look at how things actually were in the past, you see more that's familiar than you might think. People did have their favourite jousting or tournament champions, and they followed them and followed their progress. And knights could gain quite a lot of wealth and quite a lot of fame by fighting successfully in tournaments, just as in modern professional sport. The joust is slightly different. The joust is generally, it's useful to make a distinction, though, between jousts and tournaments. Tournaments could be really dangerous. And the problem for a younger knight going into a tournament fought in teams is that this younger knight might get totally destroyed by veterans coming in. And how do you bring the younger guys in without them being completely massacred? And it seems that jousts first developed as an initial pre-match kind of exercise, if you will, as one-on-one contests where younger knights could start to get a taste of this without having to hazard themselves in the tournament itself. And a joust is a much more formalized encounter fought with lances by individuals. It's an individual contest rather than a group fight. They run at each other with the lance to strike each other as hard and as accurately as they can. The basic expression of the heavy cavalry skills.
So jousts are effectively on horseback, and tournaments, I suppose, can be on horseback, but they...
As tournaments develop, a lot of the most expressly battle-like features kind of fall away. Tournaments become more formalized, and really by the 13th century, it's knights fighting other knights and on horseback, and that's it. You do, in the 15th century, you start to get foot combats, formalized foot combats or armored fencing matches, essentially, becoming popular. But in most of the history of tournaments, this is all about the horses. If you can't fight on a horse, you are not a knight. And to display your knightly prowess, the most esteemed method of fighting is from the back of a horse. The rest should be comparatively easy. But the horse part is what must really be shown and displayed at all times.
On to our next question then. So Kim Bosworth on Instagram asks, what were the actual rules to a joust? And were jousts ever fixed? Ooh, controversial. What do you reckon, Dickon?
Well, I think before jousts even started, it's worth to say that there were qualifications and restrictions on who could even take part. I mean, certainly as we move into the later part of the period we're talking about, that jousts were and tournaments were, they were often restricted to the wealthy people of pedigree, certainly in England anyway. In Germany and Holland and other places, sometimes people of lesser status couldn't join, but at least in England, you often had to be able to prove your ancestry. And often people with bad parts, if you were a slanderer or a cheat or a perjurer or something like this, you were also not able to take part. And this was part of the growing sort of restriction around tournaments and in terms of the exclusivity, to the point where the patronage of tournaments was also restricted to the magnates and the great and wealthy nobles and royalty. So the rules and the combats that would actually take place at tournaments were often agreed in advance, but we know very little about the specific rules of the joust before really the 15th century. We do have, however, sort of a set of questions from a knight called Geoffrey de Charny. Unfortunately, we don't have the answers, but most of his questions revolve around basically if a joust took place and something happened. It was mostly about the horses and who would, about the winning and loss of horses. For example, if a knight fell off his horse, who would win the horse and so on.
Do you mean who would win the joust, or would he actually win a horse if he came off the horse?
Well, exactly that type of question he's asking. Unfortunately, we only have his questions and not the answers. But it's only in the 15th century, really, we start to learn more about the scoring. And in England, luckily, we've got ordinances of Sir John Tiptoft, who was a famous knight and Lord High Constable of England. And he wrote down in 1466 some more detail about the scoring. And the highest points that could be awarded during the joust were for the unhorsing of an opponent or bringing down both the horse and a man after the two jousters had come together. This was followed by, if you're able to break spears tip to tip, that as it were came second in the scoring, then if you're able to strike your opponent on the visor three times came third, and then after that it was a question of who could break the most spears. Similarly, there are also penalties for infringement. So if you broke a spear on an opponent's saddle, or you hit the tilt was the central barrier that went down and the middle so that the horses didn't collide into each other. So if you hit that, you're given a penalty. And there are even disqualifications. So if you struck a horse with your lance, for example, that would result in a disqualification. So there were these type of rules that developed. But it's interesting that actually in this ordinance of Sir John Tiptoft, it does say that it gives these rules, but then says, reserving always to the queen and to the ladies present the attribution and gift of a prize. So even though there were rules, this sort of law of chivalry still enabled the women in the audience, the queen or whoever was the most senior, to, as it were, take precedence. If they wanted to give a prize to a particular knight for a certain reason, they could do so, despite the fact that there were certain rules laid down.
That's also sort of why it's important not to think about jousting too much as a sport in a modern sense. I mean, it has sporting-like attributes, and sometimes they keep score and they award prizes and things, but we mustn't be too literal about that. This is also a courtly exercise. It's a kind of performance art where knights prove that they have these special skills that separate them from everybody else. And they also prove the muscular power and preeminence of the nobility. This is also about making sure that the social order stays the way they want it to be, and that the common people know that their rulers are more physically powerful and capable than they are. So there's a lot of different levels to it. Yes, sometimes they keep a score by counting how many spears are broken. But as Dickens says, the court of chivalry, noble ladies can always decide that they want the winner to be whoever it is. And there are also jousting treatises later in the 15th and 16th centuries that outlay some sometimes very complex systems of rules before they say at the end, yes, but if you are jousting against a prince or a king, he always wins in deference to his status, regardless of what happens. So if that's right. Fixing, then maybe so. But it's worth mentioning, actually, on that note, that Henry VIII, of course, was a famous jousting connoisseur. And if you look at his scorecards, which survive, they're preserved, you can see that he at times did not accept that royal deference. He allowed other people to win in his jousts. And sometimes reading through the scores can tell you a lot about the attitudes of the people involved.
Where would Henry VIII have taken part in his jousts then? Was this a European sport, European practice, shall we say?
Well, of course, Henry VIII's most famous joust has to be the Field of Cloth of Gold, which took place in France. But, you know, a great diplomatic and chivalric occasion celebrating peace between England and France. But that was perhaps, you know, a very special occasion. I mean, I think most people who visit the jousts at English Heritage might imagine that tournaments and jousting always took place at castles. And to some extent, they did. I mean, tilt yards were built at Eltham in 1517, so during the reign of Henry VIII. There was also the entrance causeway that you go over as you visit Kenilworth Castle, was known as the tilt yard. Even in medieval period, must have been where jousts took place. And certainly tournaments did take place at both Eltham and Kenilworth during the period in question and in the reign of Edward III. But castles definitely weren't the only places where tournaments took place. I mean, just as often they took place in towns and cities. As Toby has mentioned, this was a way of knights to show off their prowess and also to sort of display their martial ability over and above the common people. So the best way of doing that, of course, is to do it in a place where as many people as possible can see it, or at least see part of it, even if that's just the pre-joust displays of chivalry and displays of arms that were undertaken before the tournament itself. So, of course, London was a major centre for tournaments, specifically at Smithfield, but also at some of the other marketplaces and some of the other main thoroughfares. Other tournaments took place at other cities around the UK. I mean, perhaps a more strange one is this sort of tournament or joust, really, known as the Passage of Arms. And these were occasions where a knight or a small group of knights would set themselves up at a bridge or a crossroads or somewhere in the landscape, effectively, and sent out a challenge to other knights to meet them at that place, or knights that were just passing. They would then challenge them to jousts. And this was very well known throughout Europe, and very famous jousters, for example, Jacques de Lalanne, who was a 15th century Burgundian knight who was sort of internationally famous. You know, he had one of these passages of arms, and they were often given fanciful names. I mean, one of his most famous was called the Passage of the Fountain of Tears. It was set up next to a fountain, and he invited knights to come, and then they would joust at these places in the countryside. So there were multiple places where jousts could take place. I mean, even stranger, but sometimes they took place actually during military campaigns and during military sieges. So we know at the Siege of Winchester and Lincoln, which both took place in 1141, these were military campaigns. And yet before and during the siege, the defenders and the attackers had, although semi-serious, semi-mock combats. So the defenders of the castle and the attacking army could sort of watch and see that these feats of arms in front of them. And similarly, during campaigns, during the Hundred Years' War, for example, between France and England, often individual knights from opposing armies would leave the main army for a bit and engage in combats. And most often these were jousts of war, so with sharpened spears, sharpened lances, incredibly dangerous, but a way of really displaying one's military prowess, chivalry. Especially, of course, if you won, you would then return to the army as a hero. So joust took place anywhere. It's really any occasion, and you can see it was really any excuse.
Yes, No easy answers to these questions, really, as we're proving. Jamie Mellows from Instagram wants to know how international the jousting was. You've already mentioned one person there, Dickon, but Toby, you're international because you're originally from the States. So how international was jousting?
Well, it's hugely international then, and it still is. It's probably more international now than it was in the Middle Ages. I've jousted in California and Australia, and I suspect that most medieval knights never did. But certainly it was a pan-European phenomenon, and keen jousters could travel quite significant distances to appear in important jousts. And also one of the things that I've encountered in my work is how different jousts and jousting culture could be in different parts of Europe. If you think about the situation of a joust, you have the armor, you have the horse, you have the weaponry. It can be an exercise about strength. It can be an exercise about horsemanship. It can be about the superlative handling of the weapons. Usually, to some extent, it's about all of those things, but different jousts in different parts of Europe can have radically different emphasis on one or the other. There's a wonderful kind of travel log written by a Spanish nobleman named Pero Tarfur in the 15th century. He was, you know, well acquainted with how people jousted in Spain and Portugal, but he was really amazed by how different jousts were in Germany, that they didn't use the tilt. They still ran at each other in the open field in the middle of the 15th century, by which time the tilt was known pretty much everywhere, but the Germans still chose not to use it. And their armor was much heavier, and their lances were much bigger, and their horses were stronger. And it was just about pure strength and throwing man and horse over together to the ground. Whereas, you know, the Spanish tended to joust in war armor. They tended to use war spears that are lighter than some of the bigger jousting lances. And their version of the game was much more about skill of handling and horsemanship rather than perhaps the pure getting as much strength and violence out of the game as you possibly could. But it's happening everywhere in Italy, Germany, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, France. There were, you know, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people involved in jousts every year throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. So it obviously was a much bigger phenomenon than it is now. But even today, there are probably 500 or 600 reasonably competent jousters who compete all over the world today, including at English Heritage events.
It's probably worth saying as well that the jousts that took place during the medieval period, they were often multinational events. For example, the very famous joust of St. Anglevere in 1390, where three French knights held a tournament near Calais. They sent out challenges to knights in England and knights in Germany, and I think around 60 knights from England turned up to joust them, and a large number from Germany as well. So they weren't necessarily single nation events. They could be well and truly international.
That's amazing. I liked your comment earlier, Toby, about the brute strength of the German horses and their riders. And Jeremy Arment from Facebook is interested to know about the breeds of horses that were used for jousting. So what breeds were used and were they quite different?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because it's very much like cars. You know, you have car types and then you have car makes. And, a lot of the terminology that's used in medieval documents when describing horses refers to the job that they're doing and the sort of class that they are rather than a specific breed. You know, horse breeding is a very complex business, but really the easiest way to start to get a better sense of what kind of horses they're using is to look at visual art. By the Renaissance, you have incredibly accurate depictions of knights and their horses, and the accurate sizes and proportions and everything are well replicated. And these are generally smallish horses. I mean, certain kinds of specialized jousting horses, as in Germany, sometimes could be a bit larger, but you're usually only talking about a horse that's about 15 hands tall. It's a small, compact horse. And a lot of good horse blood came from North Africa originally. And even in the Middle Ages, as is today, a lot of the best the most well-bred horses come from Spain and southern Italy. I have found references to the use of Frisian horses being used by knights for war, but, you know, breeds can evolve over time as well. So what we understand to be the Frisian breed now might not bear very much resemblance to what a 16th century person understood a Frisian horse to be. So it's the terminology and the classifications are tricky, but generally you want this short, compact horse that has very heavily muscled shoulders and hindquarters, but, you know, generally quite delicate legs, a small head, a quite powerful neck. And the back of the horse is usually quite short. You should really only have enough room for the saddle. You know, the neck should come out of the front end of the saddle and the hindquarters come out the other end. You do not have a long extended body as you see on modern racehorses, for example. They're bred to move in a very different way, to do a very different job. And, you know, horse breeds are in many ways are kind of analogous to car design now. You have to get the right horse of the right shape and size for the right job. I mean, from the horse's point of view, something like a joust is fairly straightforward. They don't have to do anything that's that hard for them. They have to stand at one end of a field, run in a straight line to the other end of the field, and stop at the other end, hopefully, and behave themselves most of the rest of the time. It's not always possible to get all of that. But from the horse's point of view, jousting should be fairly easy, especially when you have a tilt. You know, the tilt is 6.5 feet tall. It should be fully planked with planks of wood. So for the horse, it's just like running along a fence, and they shouldn't feel too frightened about the oncoming horse. Jousting in the open field is much more challenging and kind of a different matter. But most of the jousting that occurs today is run at the tilt because it's safer and generally better.
Jeremy had a follow-up question as well, which was about armor. And I think he's trying to suggest, did knights sort of win armor?
No, not really. I mean, armor's a very personal thing. And you can't have a, you know, sort of an armor set up there as a tournament prize and expect it to be of any use to whoever ends up winning. Good armor has to be totally custom made to the specific individual. It was possible to buy a lot of armor off the peg, as it were. But when you're talking about high status tournaments and jousts, you're talking about people who have all custom bespoke equipment. Having said that, you know, tournament prizes were very diverse. There's all kinds of references to strange and wonderful prizes that could be won at tournaments. Often it's a very fine jewel or some kind of really rare precious stone or some work of the jeweler's art. You know, a rose made out of gold and diamonds, or a feather made out of silver and gold, something like that. There can be also more practical prizes, like a really nice horse. We have references to that, and that's a prize that's going to be appreciated by anybody involved in this. And there are even some stranger prizes. There's a German reference to the tournament prize being an unusually large sturgeon. So, you know, if okay. you're eating a lot of fish in your diet, then you can win your dinner, I suppose.
And would there be cash prizes? Would there be cash prizes so you could improve your armor if your armor as a novice might not have been as good?
Well, I mean, earlier on, I mean, certainly in like the 12th and 13th centuries, in the older style, more warlike tournaments, there was this process of ransoming, that if you can capture one of your enemies, he has to buy his freedom from you, and you sometimes get to keep all of his equipment. And early tournaments in the 12th and 13th centuries were often a way of poorer or lower status knights, you know, making a significant amount of money and also increasing their status and their fame. By the later Middle Ages, that's not really so much of an issue. And, you know, prize money as such is kind of vulgar, and it's sort of beneath the dignity of the people involved in these things generally. If you're able to equip yourself to take part in a late medieval joust, then, you know, you're probably not worrying about your bus fare home.
Okay. Next question from Hannah Walsh_03 from Instagram. She asks, Was jousting used to prove the strength and honour of a knight? I think we sort of covered this at the start, didn't we, Dickon?
It's interesting for the times where it's the opposite. For example, Henry V disliked jousts and what have you. So I think there's a short answer, yes, but with a
caveat.
Exactly, yes. So I think it's still worth asking it, if you see what I mean.
So what are the other conditions, shall we say? So it's yes, but on conditions.
I mean, obviously, taking part in tournaments and winning tournaments was a hugely prestigious thing. And there are knights who became incredibly famous through winning tournaments. I mean, in the early period, you've got people like William Marshall, who rose from relatively obscurity to being one of the main nobles in the kingdom. And certainly tournaments and his prowess in them played a massive part. And in the later period as well, we've got individually famous knights. But however, not everyone who you might expect did like tournaments. So, I mean, there were famous kings like Edward II who really distrusted tournaments because they saw them as having potential for knights who were against the king to join up together and form an army and then attack him. But then other actual very well-known military figures, Henry V of Agincourt fame, very famously disliked jousts and preferred his knights to engage in real combat. And I think as an example of this, I mean, Henry V got married to Catherine of France, a daughter of the King of France, and the French proposed customary sort of celebratory jousts, to which Henry turned round and replied that any knights who wanted to take part in tournaments would much better prove themselves by going and besieging the city of Sens. So although most knights, I think it's fair to say, were very pro tournaments, not everybody was. It was up to the individual.
And the church was often profoundly opposed to tournaments. So some knights who are more pious and more concerned with obeying the rule of the church would reject tournaments as well as frivolous wastes of one's time and energy.
I think we equally covered two similar questions earlier. This is from Perry_Inge from Instagram and Iman Ramsey from Facebook asking, was it just noblemen who were able to joust? We sort of answered that, didn't we, really earlier, I think.
Well, you could say a bit more about that. I mean, generally, the main tournament culture is an aristocratic one. But therefore, it is also kind of bound up in the class struggles that start to appear with the rise of the middle classes after the Black Death in the 15th and 16th centuries. You start to get urban, middle class, upwardly mobile, affluent people who are ambitious and you want to demand a certain prestige of their own and resent the traditional dominance of the agrarian aristocracy. And actually, in Germany, in the 15th and 16th centuries, you do start to get a culture of tournaments among the urban patricians, or common people, not aristocrats, but affluent middle-class people who kind of start to appropriate the honor of tournaments for themselves. And in the city of Nuremberg, from the 15th century, there were annual Gesellenstecken, as they were called, or bachelor's jousts, where the young members of the merchant families would rent armors that were provided by the city, decorate them at their own expense, and then joust, very much in the manner of knights and kind of taking the traditional trappings of the aristocracy away from them. And obviously the noblemen didn't appreciate this. There were also satirical jousts where the merchant classes went out of their way to have satirical tournaments that made fun of the aristocrats, where they would wear crests on their helmets with sausages on sticks, and they would joust on ponies bareback with wickerwork helmets and lances, and it was kind of hilarious. And again, not appreciated very much by the aristocracy.
I appreciate that one, though. I like that one. What about women? Did they ever take part?
Well, women were involved as judges and as, the presiding officials in tournaments. And often women in the culture of chivalry are noble ladies who are higher ranking than the knights themselves, are often seen as a way of inspiring young knights to risk their lives to greater deeds of arms than they might otherwise be willing to do so. So women are an essential element in all of chivalry, but it's only in our generation today where you have really skilled women jousters. Historically, that didn't happen.
And you agree with that, Dickon?
Yeah, you know, of course. I mean, I think it's when we talk about tournaments, though. I mean, and we're focusing, of course, on the jousting and the military combats. But these were often much larger affairs. Certainly, talking as we go into the 15th century, where it was wrapped around with other occasions, sort of dances and feasts and what have you. And at these events, of course, the women were, again, you know, absolutely vital and just as important, if not more important, than the men. For example, there was one of the famous tournaments that took place in Burgundy, for example. The main feast was presided over by the Duchess of Burgundy, while the Duke of Burgundy dined privately in his personal private apartment. So at that occasion, it was the Duchess who was taking center stage. And you know, that's far from the only occasion where that happened. So it's even though women didn't take part in the actual sport, they were still just as important in many other regards.
Yes, it's a very varied story, isn't it, throughout history. We did have another question from the Castles of England on Instagram, who was asking, was it a high society only pastime? And I think we've answered that as well by saying yes broadly, but there were obviously other classes getting involved in other countries at other times in history. So, but thank you for your question anyway. Let's move on to some questions about equipment. When did specialized jousting equipment appear, Toby?
Well, this goes back to the essential problem with training for warfare. How do you replicate the fighting as seriously as possible without killing everyone? And for a long time, throughout the 12th century, the weapons that they were using in jousts and tournaments were the same as the ones used on the battlefield. War spears, sharp swords, the armor of war, and it was pretty dangerous. Once everybody started to understand that some kind of safety measure needed to be put in place for more peaceful tournaments and jousts and things, the initial measure is pretty obvious. It's just to use blunted spearheads and blunted swords. Take the sharpness off. That's the first thing that happens in the late 12th and 13th centuries. And then this is an evolving thing. You start to see early evidence of certain specialized bits of armor in the later 13th century, and then it starts to develop and diversify along a separate kind of evolutionary path in the 14th and 15th centuries.
How did they keep it relatively safe then? Because I'm imagining if you're going roughly 25 miles an hour, maybe 30 miles an hour on a horse, holding a blunted spear, there's still going to be quite a lot of kickback when that spear connects with the shield of the opponent. So there must have been some scope for injury.
It depends. I mean, in an Iberian account that I'm working on at the moment, which has a lot of description of individual jousting encounters, the author again and again he has this phrase that refers to a reversal of fortune. He might describe one joust and he says, on this occasion, the jousters suffered only a minor reversal of fortune. And then another one, they say they suffered a terrible reversal of fortune. And what he's doing with that phrase is precisely what you ask about. He is describing the amount of recoil or kick, if you will, that the jousters experience, both from the hit that they are being given and by the recoil of the weapon that they are hitting with. But the amount of force that you experience can, in an individual jousting course, an individual run, can vary enormously. But the armor, you know, if the full plate armor is there to protect you against that. And by the late 14th century, if not earlier, knights are habitually using the lance rest, which is a little metal bracket on the right side of the breastplate, kind of sitting over the right pectoral muscle. That little arm or bracket locks onto the lance. So the lance can't be blown backwards into your arm and shoulder and hand on impact. It's mechanically linked to your armor. So that was a device that helped knights deliver as much of the potential energy to their opponent as possible and hopefully not hurt their hand or their arm too much. I mean, injuries from the impacts can still occur. I've had a few minor ones myself. It kind of goes with the territory. But weird things can happen in jousts. You know, if you both hit well, if your opponent hits you well and you hit him, the blows can kind of cancel each other out and you sort of bounce off each other and you don't actually feel very much. Some of the worst kind of recoil I've ever experienced is when I hit well, but my opponent misses and doesn't hit me at all, because then Newton's third law of motion comes into play and everything you deliver to your opponent comes straight back onto you. And it's like hitting a brick wall. The physics of it are quite strange and surprising sometimes. And when people go to modern jousts now, it's worth watching quite closely to see what happens to the bodies of the people involved and try and work out where the energy is going.
Well, I thought it was going through the spears, which appear to be made of a quite sort of fragile wood from what I've seen on videos. Is that right?
Sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. I mean, different tournaments have different classes and different rules. Most jousts at English Heritage use frangible lances that are designed to break. But right. Other jousts that occur on the continent use, you know, solid pine lances that will break, but they require more in the breaking, you might say.
Holly underscore on history from Instagram says, I'd love to find out more about the practical reasons for knights' helmet design changes. What can you tell us about the history of helmet design?
All armor design, just like really all technology, the form that something like a helmet takes is entirely governed by the specific purpose that you have for that piece of equipment. So, you know, that's the functional environment tells you what the form and design of the helmet needs to be. So in a joust, you are doing something very specific and predictable. You are going to be running from one end of the field to the other. You are going to be trying to hit an opponent in the head or the shield when you get halfway down, and he's going to try and hit you in the head or the shield. And then you're just going to do that over and over and over again until somebody wins and somebody else says stop. And you know that this is a controlled environment. You're only going to be in the armor for about 45 minutes to an hour. And there are lots of friendly people all around on the ground to stop and help you with anything you need. You know, so the nature of that environment is very specific. And the job description for the helmet is very well defined. It has to protect you against one lance at a time coming and hitting you straight on. And here are the dangers, and this is the situation, and these are the kind of design parameters. And that's one thing. And it leads to the helmet tending to be very heavily built, with very thick plates, very heavy, with a kind of prow-like form, like the bow of a ship, to make sure that the splinters, they fly away from the eyes. You have to protect the eyes first and foremost. It can be heavier because you're not going to be wearing it for very long, and it has to be, you know, really dependable protection. That's a very different job description than a helmet for war. In warfare, you might be wearing it for much longer periods of time, and you might be fighting in all kinds of different, unpredictable fighting environments where breathing is more important and being able to see and communicate is more important. And there are all kinds of other things that the designer of war armor has to be worried about beyond how much protection can I give the wearer. So it's really like the difference in designing a hybrid Toyota hatchback that you're going to use to take the children to school versus some huge, gigantic dump truck that's going to be transporting rocks from a building site. You know, those are both vehicles that have four wheels and an engine, but they have different jobs. So everything about their form and their physicality is different.
I guess the other thing to say as well, during this period, I mean, the technology of metallurgy is completely transformed. You know, from the early 1100s to the late 1500s, the development of armor technology completely changes, so that in the 15th century, they're just able to produce so much more sophisticated, larger pieces of armor than they were beforehand. And this enables the changes in armor design that Toby's just outlined.
William Coyne from Facebook would like to know if frogmouth jousting helmets were ever used in battle. So first, could you explain what a frogmouth helmet is, Toby?
Yeah, that's what I was sort of describing just now. It's a very heavy head defense made out of quite thick metal, especially in the front, but it has a very distinctive prow-like shape. It scoops up and out from the neck to a point quite far out in front of the eyes. And it's designed to really give maximum protection to the eyes when an opponent is hit in the lower face or in the shield, and then the lance skips up. It's designed to keep things from getting into the eye slot or the ocularium of the helmet, while also being made of very thick metal, so it prevents penetration as well. In jousts, the primary target is the head. That's what you want to be able to hit. In warfare, that's a great way of killing a knight, so you need to practice that, and jousting equipment needs to allow you to do that safely. So it's a very heavily built and very sculptural kind of object. There are certain 15th century illustrations that sometimes show the odd knight or soldier wearing such a distinctive piece of jousting paraphernalia in a battle environment. And that's led some people to wonder if they were ever worn in battle. I think mostly they weren't, but you know, sometimes a big heavy helmet is exactly what you need, something that's bolted down to the body armor. You can see a situation where, like in a siege or something like that, it might turn out that it's advantageous to grab your jousting helm and stick that on. It's not unheard of. In the 14th century, there's a reference to a French knight in a sea battle. His men put him in a jousting hauberk, or a tournament hauberk, a mail coat that's said to be specifically for tournament fighting. And yet they decide this is what we need for a naval fight where people are shooting arrows and throwing darts and javelins down on us. So you never can underestimate when a piece of equipment that's made for one thing might turn out to be the right thing for something else. But jousting helms are not for warfare, and they're not designed for that, and generally that's not what they're good for. You wear the right equipment for the job because your life depends on it.
The weight of a typical suit of armor is a question from Sheer Mama, I think, number one, from Instagram. And also, how much would the weapons weigh? So the weight of a typical suit of armor first.
Again, armor, just like helmets, there are different armors for different jobs. A specialized jousting armor tended to be much heavier than a war armor. But war armor was often used for jousting all the way through its history. In the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, you always are finding lots of jousting happening in war equipment. And war or field armor tends to weigh between 20 and 35 kilos. 20 kilos is about as light as it can be and still have enough metal on the body to do the basic job. You can't really go lighter than that. You just don't have enough protection. And 35 kilos is starting to get to the maximum of what the human body can cope with practically before the equipment really starts to catastrophically slow you down and tire you out too fast, however fit and well-trained you are. So 20 to 35 kilos is generally the range that you're dealing with. Specialized jousting armor, especially German jousting armor, could get up to like 50 kilos. But that's very unusual, and that's for a very precise type of joust where you're only going to be wearing it for short periods of time.
I like how you're using kilos and you're from the States. That's quite funny.
It's one of the weird habits I've gotten into.
Do you know what it is in pounds for our North American listeners?
Oh, now you're tying me in knots.
I can give it a shot. So there's an Italian field armor in the Kelvingrove Museum that's around 1450. That's £57. although it's missing a couple of bits, but only small. So that's about £57, where a German armor for the Gesteck type joust, which is, again, one of these very heavily or very heavy armors specifically for the a type of German joust, was around £90. So
that's getting about as heavy as anything could ever get. And most of the time, I guess, in an old style, you're talking about 45 to 60 pounds. 70 pounds is starting to get towards the ceiling of the recommended weight from my point of view.
And the lances, how much would they be to carry?
The lances aren't really that heavy. The main thing about them is they're like 12 feet long, and they have a steel spearhead on the end, which creates balance issues. Good lance technique is really important. You need to handle that thing skillfully and with a lot of training and discipline. Otherwise, if the balance goes in the wrong way, you can drop it, you can hurt someone, you can drop it on your horse's head. There's all kinds of bad things that can happen because it's not that it's heavy so much as it can be quite ungainly if you're not handling it properly. There's a certain amount of strength that you just have to have, but you also need good technique. The jousting treatises of the 15th and 16th centuries talk a lot about the handling of the lance. Where do you rest it? What are the different resting positions? Are you resting the butt of the lance on your foot, on your thigh, on your knee, on your hip? When do you raise it up to your shoulder? How do you lower it? All of that handling is hugely important. And generally, when you're watching a joust today, you know, you can tell who's good at it and who's not by how they're handling the lance. If the lance is all over the place and getting dropped on the floor and, you know, generally not very well controlled, that's probably someone who doesn't have a lot of experience. If that lance is always vertical and it never moves from the vertical, no matter what else is happening, until it's lowered slowly and methodically in the gallop as you're approaching your opponent, then you know that that's a person who knows what they're doing. We've only recently discovered this stuff. You know, the people have only been reading and trying to implement the lessons that we find in the jousting treatises of the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance for, you know, a decade or so. It's still, you know, really top level jousting is still a fairly new phenomenon in the modern world.
How long did it take for knights to put on their armor is a question from Jonathan R. Goodman on Instagram. So how long does it take to get suited up?
Well, you can get it done really fast if you need to, but generally it's a good idea not to rush. It depends who's helping you and how good they are at it, how accustomed your helpers are to doing this kind of thing, and your armor in particular. It's possible to get an armor on in 10 or 15 minutes if you really need to, but it's important not to rush. You know, if I have my choice, I'll take a good hour and a half to put my armor on and just put some of it on, sit down, have a drink, sit around, stay relaxed. You know, your mental state when you go into this is really important. It's important to stay calm and focused and serious. And you mustn't be flustered or frustrated or stressed out or anything like that, especially when you're going to get onto the back of a highly trained horse who immediately will know everything about what's going on in your head. If you're stressed and angry and annoyed because you're being rushed, then your horse is not going to be happy either. So it's good to take an hour or 90 minutes if you have the luxury.
Another practical consideration, of course, is the heat once you've got your suit on. So Lady Sharp 60 from Instagram wants to know how knights coped under a full suit of armor on a really hot day.
It's a challenge to any soldier, any fighting man, any martial artist. Part of your job is dealing with physical discomfort and, you know, extremes of various kinds. I've worn armor in very cold weather and very hot weather, and it's not much fun in either. But if you're in good physical condition and you're well trained, you can deal with it, you know, to a point. I fought in close to 40 degrees centigrade in California, and that was very tough. In hotter weather, it does get very tough. And there are references in Italy, for example, of in warfare, commanders having barrels of water kept behind the lines of their army so that when they rotate tired knights out of the fighting, they can dunk their heads and just try and lower their temperature a little bit. And a bucket of water to stick your head in or a hose to stick down the breastplate in very hot weather is usually a good idea.
I think it's worth saying, though, that although tournaments could take place throughout the year, there were particular times of year where we know they were particularly popular as well. So, I mean, they were often associated with Shrovetide, which is the festival before Lent. So this is in the first, what, quarter or third of the year. And to a lesser extent, tournaments occur in the records at Christmas and Easter as well. So this is not at least the height of summer where temperatures would get very hot, you know, very high. And then again, tournaments often took place in the afternoon, largely because, as Toby's just said, the process of arming and organizing knights took a long time. I mean, jousts could even take place at night. For example, in 1357, Edward III jousted at Bristol at night time. So I think it's, you know, although obviously heat and the summer sun were definitely things that knights had to think about when they put on their armour, they could, if they were organised in advance, they could, or often did have tournaments when it wasn't such a big concern.
Now, final listener question is probably the most important one, and that is, how do you go to the toilet while wearing armour? So this is from Khaki Gory Photography from Instagram.
That always comes up somewhere, doesn't it? And I can immediately refer you to an English tournament manuscript of the middle of the 15th century that's now in a library in New York, but it explains how to put your armor on piece by piece. But one of the things it says by way of preparation is that you should void yourself entirely before beginning the process of arming. And that's the most important thing. Once you've done that and you're in the armor, in my experience, it won't come up again. You know, your body is working, you're perspiring, and I've been in armor for hours and never had that problem as long as you follow the appropriate 15th century advice.
That's good advice. Definitely. Okay, well, thank you to everyone who sent in questions on the English Heritage social media channels, which of course represent some of the ways you can stay updated with jousting events this season alongside the English Heritage website. So when and where can people experience jousts for themselves at English Heritage sites over the coming months, Dickon?
So they can see them at Kenilworth Castle, at Pendennis Castle, at Bolsover Castle and Scarborough Castle, and also on St George's Day at Rest Park House and Gardens.
So broadly speaking, there's quite a lot of places dotted around the country that one of those places should be near you, hopefully.
Exactly.
And for you, Toby, are you going to any jousts? And what's the atmosphere like? How would you describe it as someone who's actually a participant?
I am. I mean, when you're in armor, you know, a lot of your senses are reduced somewhat. And also being in full plate armor on the back of a stallion, it focuses the mind. And you have to make choices about what you're going to be paying attention to. But, you know, sometimes jousts really can have quite extraordinary atmosphere. I've jousted in different parts of Europe on real tournament grounds where I know that real knights jousted there in the 15th century in town squares or under the walls of some of the Europe's greatest castles. You have a job to do, and sometimes you're not really thinking beyond that. But other times you can take a break and look around and you think to yourself, well, how on earth did I end up here?
As someone who's been in the crowd, actually, and seen Toby jousting among others, I mean, I would highly recommend it. It's the crowd often gets really involved, and it is an experience to take you back 500, 600 years to see what something was like in a way which you can't do with other events. And you know, not only is there jousting, there's also often falconry, and you know, that's of course the great sport of the medieval Europe that we haven't mentioned yet, but you know, falconry was often just as popular as jousting, and you can experience that as well. So I think the whole day when you go and sit to one of the English Heritage jousts is really worthwhile and really, really fun for both adults and kids.
Well, thanks, gents, for talking us through the history of tournaments and jousting. It's been really fascinating. And I suppose all we need to do now is just say, well, saddle up.
Avaunt.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we uncover the links between Stonehenge and a rare phenomenon known as the Major Lunar Standstill.
What it's defining is a period, once in a generation, once every 19 years, when the moon can occasionally be seen rising very far north or very far south, or setting very far north or very far south.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.